You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Puccini. Today's GP Soccer Podcast is brought to you by the DiBernardo School of Soccer, Yanni Training, Project Goal, My Soccer Advocate, and GP Voiceover Services. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast Season 4 Special Series, The State of the Game, an in-depth look at the current status of the game across the United States. Hey there, everyone. Giovanni Puccini here of the GP Soccer Podcast. Listen, just settle in for what will be another wonderful conversation today, another wonderful interview with a great guest, Brian Thorpe. Brian Thorpe is the technical director for the Louisiana Soccer Association. And after the break, Brian and I were going to get into a great conversation relative to the state of the game. We're going to learn a lot of what's going on down there in Louisiana, of which, again, he oversees the state association. Brian's also got a background in similar capacities in Pennsylvania and in Michigan. So I can talk about three states or three areas of the country with Brian relative to the state of the game. So he's going to bring forth some terrific information that I know you will enjoy. Now, listen, if you have been following along, and a lot of you have, I know you have, which is great. Please continue to do so. And please tell everyone to do the same. You have now, even though we're in the early episodes of the state of the game, I think you're starting to get a feel for what's kind of going on out there. You know, our opening guest from season four, the state of the game, episode one, was with Patrick Yanni Training, Skip Gilbert, the USYS, Nancy Feldman over at Boston University, head women's soccer coach, Ian Barker, director of coaching education for United Soccer Coaches. And last week, our episode featured Tim Bradbury, which was an episode that was very, very well received. Really covered some great ground with him. And we've got, you know, many more guests coming up. Again, this is going to be a 20-episode endeavor. This is going to go into June here in 2021. So, and there's going to be a lot of guests, again, from various levels that I believe that after every single guest, you're understanding, appreciating, knowing what's kind of going on out there above and beyond your own world, if you will, in soccer. That's going to be deepened and appreciated. We've got some terrific folks coming up. Deb Raber, head women's soccer coach at Mass College of Liberal Arts out in North Adams, Massachusetts. Gareth Smith, Phil Whidden, goalkeeper coach at Philadelphia Union. Doug Williamson, great friend and colleague of mine with the United Soccer Coaches. And the list goes on and on and on. Again, we're going to go right into June, deep into June with this topic of the state of the game. So I'm hoping you're enjoying it. The feedback so far has been really good. You know, just trying to kind of keep things going, as they say. As you know, shifting gears just a little bit, I like to say or talk about that the GP Soccer Podcast is a mini coaching education course. And that's kind of the cornerstone of all of this, of why I kind of started all this. As you know, if you've been listening since season one, going back to season one, my original career intent was radio and TV broadcasting. It had nothing to do with sports or athletics or soccer or physical education, all the things I eventually got into. But it was radio and TV broadcasting. And lo and behold, these many years later, technology being what it is, here I am behind the microphone and kind of enjoying, you know, that, you know, original career intent, coupling it with, you know, what I'm doing now in the sport of soccer, which thankfully is rather substantive. And so you combine those two things, it's an opportunity for me. Yeah, you were in radio, Giovanni, tripping over your words. But it provided me an opportunity to create this GP Soccer Podcast as, a mini coaching education course. So kind of in that spirit, you know, there is an opportunity, and I've touched upon this in the past, and I know Ian Barker and I have touched upon this in conversations we've had on air, about getting your master's degree in soccer coaching education. Now, if you're someone in, say, you know, in academia, you're a high school teacher, or you're at the collegiate level, or you've got to secure a master's degree for, you know, a pay increment, and you're in the sport of soccer, this is just a terrific opportunity offered by Ohio University, and they're accepting, you know, applications now, and you can finish this thing in under 2 years. It's the only sport-specific master's program in the United States, and it's got a terrific faculty, one of whom is Dr. David Carr, who was a guest on the GP Soccer Podcast back in season one. So I encourage you to go back to season one and listen to that interview with Dr. David Carr. Terrific curriculum, convenience, and last but not least, it's cost-effective. What a bargain, right? Cost-effective. If you'd like to know more about securing an online master's degree in soccer coaching education, just go to ohio.edu/education/soccer, and you can get all the information you need about getting a master's degree in soccer coaching education. Terrific opportunity, really is. You know, we're in this country, we're, you know, very familiar with getting coaching education licenses, either through United Soccer Coaches or through U.S. Soccer. But it's a relatively new phenomenon about taking a truly academic track to bettering yourself, improving yourself as a soccer professional, as a teacher of the game here in the United States. And here we are with Ohio University offering this online master's degree in soccer coaching education. So check it out. Let's switch gears again, right? Switching gears again. So last season, we had a young man by the name of Warren Backman on the show. Warren and I worked together over at Regis College, where I am the goalkeeper coach. Warren was the graduate assistant, a terrific young man. And I had Warren on because I wanted to interview someone, you know, who's on the beginning, in the beginning of their journey to becoming a soccer professional, in the beginning phases of them, then wanted to coach the game of soccer and get their perspective. I think it's important because not every one of my members of the audience out there, not everyone out there, you know, starts at the top rung. We all start at the bottom rung of the ladder. We make our way up. So it was important that I have Warren on and kind of get his perspective. So Warren is moving up the proverbial ladder. Warren is heading down to Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida, to serve as the assistant coach down there at Lynn University, which has a rather successful program. I think they're in Division II, the NCAA, a bit of the Wild West Division II. So shout out to Warren, and best of luck as you make your way down to sunny Florida. He's leaving chilly New England, going back down to sunny Florida, which is his home state. Best of luck, Warren, and make sure you stay in touch, and hopefully your climbing the ladder will eventually take you back up here to chilly New England. So best of luck to Warren. So our guest today, again, is going to be Brian Thorpe. We'll re-engage on the other side. And I hope you'll enjoy our conversation. We get into a number of areas in the sport of soccer. This is Giovanni Pacini tripping over his words with regularity in this opening block. But hey, it is what it is, folks. It is what it is. So we'll connect on the other side with Brian Thorpe. Brian Thorpe, don't you dare go anywhere. The DiBernardo School of Soccer is the only online cognitive soccer diploma course offered in the world. Coach Marcus DiBernardo is one of the leading experts on cognitive soccer and player development, has been a consultant to MLS teams, European professional clubs, and served as the cognitive soccer expert for the European soccer publication, Trainers Magazine. Be sure to check out Coach DiBernardo's work on his YouTube channel, The DiBernardo Soccer Methodology, and on Instagram under Marcus DiBernardo. For further information, visit thedibernardoschoolofsoccer.com. There is an outstanding program that has impacted the lives of over 1,000 Rhode Island middle school youth, providing academic enrichment and using soccer as an incentive towards increased academic performance and an overall support for success. Project Goal is a 100% free co-educational program designed to inspire academic success through the reward of soccer. Project Goal students are afforded targeted academic enrichment with accredited teachers and earn an equal amount of time in soccer training with licensed coaches. All this in an environment that fosters academic and social accountability, with the aim of developing educated and compassionate students. Project Goal has maintained a steady high school graduation rate of 96%, with 90% going off to college. Supported by the FIFA Foundation for the past 12 years, Project Goal is the model for reaching into our ethnic communities and providing high-quality educational and athletic opportunities. To learn more, visit Project Goal at projectgoal.org.
Hi, this is Nancy Feldman, head women's soccer coach at Boston University. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with host Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I'm your host, Giovanni Pacini, in a new season. season 4 of the GP Soccer Podcast. And as you all know by now, we're several episodes into this season 4 theme of the state of the game. You know, we're trying to talk to a lot of people across the country who have a significant role in the state of the game here in the United States, and at every level, from a youth coach to a high school coach, folks from USYS and you know, different state organizations. And at the end of it all, as I've noted to you in the past, it'll be up to you, my listening audience, to determine what is the state of the game here in the United States, based upon your hopefully listening to each and every one of these episodes. So as I noted to all of you at the opening of the show, our guest today is Brian Thorpe. And Brian Thorpe is the technical director of coaching education and player development for Louisiana Soccer Association. And we're going to spend some time talking about what he does in Louisiana. But Brian's background also includes, as I noted to you earlier, some work in PA and Pennsylvania, and in Michigan. So I want to kind of get into those landscapes as well. So Brian is great because he can kind of kill three birds with one stone for me. So with all that said, Brian Thorpe, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Giovanni, for that introduction. I'm not sure if I deserve it, but I appreciate it. And thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss, I think, what most of us feel is a passion and profession all in one. So I'm excited. Thank you.
Great. No, my pleasure to have you on board, really. So you have a little bit of a New England connection. I know you're originally from, correct me if I'm wrong, from Delaware.
That's right. Correct.
But you found your way to New England at Bowdoin College. What brought you up to Bowdoin in Maine?
Wow. I'll try and be as brief as I can. I've always been fascinated with history. And when I was doing my college search, as well as playing search, the opportunity to be a part of a college that had significant history, not only from the Civil War to the literature, but also to modern day politics. And obviously the opportunity to play in NESCAC. I mean, I think Giovanni... I think we could argue that the NESCAC is one of the premier conferences for Division III sports across the country. So, you know, it ticked a lot of boxes for me.
Well, I can tell you firsthand, having been a collegiate head coach for, oh, goodness, Brian, 26, 27, 20 years. It's all a blur at this point. I'm very familiar with NESCAC and the colleges that of which I was head coach at. We did compete with NESCAC schools and found, you know, varying success, you know, against those schools. And yeah, I would concur with you that the NESCAC is arguably the premier Division III soccer conference in the country. You know this firsthand. You see Division I level players across the spectrum there at NESCAC schools. So yeah, there's some high level soccer being played there. Now, down there in Louisiana, you also have another kind of New England connection with Tucker Reynolds. He's your executive director. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Originally from Massachusetts. Yep.
That is. And coach soccer there, was it Framingham State?
Framingham State, correct. Yep. So I guess we from Massachusetts, we should be heading our way down to Louisiana?
Well, the weather, I think, is a little bit better this time of year for sure. So how about that?
There you go. Well, as you and I were talking off air in preparation for this this interview on air, we touched upon COVID-19. Now, for my listening audience, we are now, you know, in early 2021, early January. We've just turned the corner, thankfully, from 2020. The episode will be out in a couple months' time, in about March. But nonetheless, I would be remiss as a host. I would be remiss relative to, you know, probing into the state of the game without bringing up COVID-19, because it has permeated into everything. Well, let's be frank, everything, but certainly in the game of soccer. So, Brian, relative to your work down in Louisiana with Louisiana Soccer Association, what were the challenges at the earliest stages, and then as you began to grapple with the COVID-19, what were the rules, the regulations? What steps did you take to ensure that you could do something, if anything?
No, you know, Giovanni, I think the one thing we've learned here is, you know, flexibility is key. One of the major issues, unfortunately, that happened, and I think this is probably true at every state level, is, you know, the pandemic became politicized. So depending on where your governor and where your local city mayors, whatever, decided to kind of enforce. What we did is we took our guidance from the health department here in Louisiana, had some calls with them, as well as with some other committees across the state. We were on a pause for quite a long time. We didn't get back into playing until almost about mid to late August. And so the fall season was quite compressed for us. We had some protocols to follow that were developed in-house, but as well as in coordination with health departments. The political side of it was quite interesting, Giovanni, to be honest with you, because other sports were playing, but soccer was listed as what they would consider a, I think, tier two, tier three contact sport. So us, football, were kind of sidelined, but yet other sports like baseball, cross country, volleyball were still playing. So it was challenging, not only for us as a state association, but I think for our coaches and our parents as well. And till this day, it's still challenging because we still have obviously protocols in place. That determine, you know, the overall development of our coaches as well as our players.
Yeah, you know, you try, particularly in this day and age, you try to stay away from political discussion. But as I've noted on many occasions, both, you know, here on my show and in, you know, privately, there are many times where sports and politics clash. Right. I think oftentimes it's just an inevitability. And certainly with COVID, it has been politicized. And through that politicization, if that's even a word, you see that, you know, making your job even more difficult, even more difficult. Let me ask you this, Brian. Were there any game, would you play any games? Number one, were there any games being played at any point in Louisiana?
So in Louisiana, up until we were cleared to play, like I said, towards the end of August, our teams actually had to travel outside the state to neighboring states like Texas, as an example, to play their games. In fact, our training was restricted, if you will, to, let's just call it factory work, you know, skill training, one player, one ball, spaced out 6 feet away. So there was no, if you will, team-oriented or line-oriented training. So when I say we were restricted, we were severely restricted, but yet neighbors, you know, we're not. And that's where it became quite complicated, Giovanni, because, you know, we have teams, we have insurance, we have protocols in our state that we felt were comfortable and viable. But at the same time, it's difficult to police everything, right? So we had a difficult time to see, you know, how do we keep our players healthy mentally and physically, and our coaches mentally and physically, but at the same time stay within the parameters of our own local government. But yet we had neighbors that were, you know, making it much more challenging for us.
Was there ever a point in your early discussions with staff to just shut it down? And when I say shut it down, we're just not playing. Because the risk, whether it be low risk, moderate risk, or high risk, any risk was too much. Was there any discussion, any thought given to just not playing until this thing, you know, would go away or be abolished?
You know, great question, Giovanni. I think that question came up, I would say, on a daily basis. I mean, you know, we were shut down for quite a while. We had a lot of clubs that were struggling financially. We had, if you will, I'm going to call it weekly meetings with small groups, and if you will, bi-monthly meeting with larger groups across the state with those similar questions. So I would be lying to you if I said we never thought about that question. But I think at the end of the day, it was, you know, good, bad, and differently, Giovanni. We're in a youth sporting business. And, you know, as much as we want to say this is a passion, it's also a profession. And so, you know, youth sports employs, you know, millions of people across the country. but also is a livelihood for thousands of people and a healthy practice for another million set of kids. And I'll be the first one to tell you, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was in the middle of a circus trying to juggle a chainsaw, a soccer ball, a tennis ball, and a bowling pin. It was challenging. A lot of sleepless nights, a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah, I could well imagine. Now, up here in New England, you know, depending on which state you travel to, Massachusetts, here in Mass, we had, it was fairly stringent in terms of, you know, for example, game modifications, which I'm going to get into in a second. Whereas you travel just due north, where I do some work, you know, with USYS and ODP up in New Hampshire, you know, there were virtually no restrictions. I mean, I conducted a, you know, an ODP training session where the only quote unquote restriction was you had to wear a mask when you're on the sideline. And that was it. You know, there was no restrictions in play and physicality. And then, I guess, you drive over the border in Massachusetts where, you know, things were totally modified. Were there any modifications? And I'll kind of string back here to Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Early on in the youth game and in the high school season last fall, we had things like no heading. You couldn't create, you know, a wall as we now know. You had to have social distancing. Throw-ins were replaced by kick-ins. You know, kids had to wear masks on the field. The idea of contact or was deemed as, you know, incidental contact or intentional contact, and you were left to the, you know, the opinions of the referees, which is always sketchy at best. You know, to determine that. Were there any modifications made in Louisiana, you know, in the youth game that you oversee, or even at the high school level, similar to that?
Yeah. So, you know, we had conversations with multiple levels with officials as well as health service industries. Our modifications, I'd say, were relatively mild compared to Massachusetts. The games were as is. We tried to keep parents and players, if you will, connected, but also distanced. So what I mean by that was we tried to limit, you know, fans to two fans to one player. Fans and players generally from the same team were on the same side. So we went back to that, the old days, as you, I'm sure you remember, Giovanni, where, you know, the team and the parents were on the same side of the field versus two teams on the same side of the field. During training, we recommended masks. As much as you could. We recommended spacing of players during water breaks. And we obviously would recommend, you know, limit to zero, to almost zero carpooling as much as you could. Mm-hmm. So I would say our recommendations and our protocols were very mild compared to Massachusetts. But at the same time, you know, we feel the need to make sure that we have things in place that that demonstrate, you know, the willingness to participate in a safe environment.
So let's kind of move beyond this, and it's almost a breath of fresh air when I can say this. Let's move beyond COVID and get into, you know, the soccer landscape as you have experienced it. And again, even as I say this, Brian, I got a big smile on my face, moving beyond COVID. So you're responsible for 35,000 players, 3,000 coaches through Louisiana Soccer Association. What was the landscape? What did the landscape look like upon your arrival in Louisiana? Where did you see the strengths and the positives? Were there areas that needed improvement? And discuss with the audience, you know, the challenges you faced when recognizing said areas of improvement in order to make the complete soccer landscape that much better.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to step backwards a little bit, I mean, Louisiana, I think sometimes we forget from a soccer standpoint, we've had upwards of, I think it's 3 to 4 Herman Trophy winners. You know, Jason Christ, obviously, being a player and coach that was raised here in Louisiana. So we do have a bit of a soccer culture. The great thing about Louisiana is it's sports mad. So, you know, the parents, the players, everything, they're fanatic about sports, you know, and recreational outdoor activities. So from that standpoint, you had a great foundation. I think overall, the biggest challenge has always been in any state is, you know, how do you manage the different cities, right? So just like in Massachusetts, you know, you have the Boston area and the greater Boston area, but that area is totally different than central Mass and western Mass. And, you know, Louisiana is the same, Giovanni. You know, the culture in New Orleans is different than the North Shore culture. And then you get to Baton Rouge, which is different. Then you get to Lafayette, which is different. And then you get to Shreveport, which is totally different as well. So trying to, you know, help each one of those cities, you know, maintain their culture, but at the same time, find ways to, if you will, increase the foundation and growth of the sport. That's always going to be a challenge, I think, in any state.
So you mentioned, you know, the varying communities, and that's indicative of, you know, of any state in the United States, whether it's as small as Rhode Island or as vast as California. Mm-hmm. You know, different communities have different personalities and challenges and that type of thing. Were you able, Brian, to yourself to get out to all these communities or the majority of these communities to see firsthand, to experience firsthand what's going on in their respective communities? From an administrative standpoint, or from a structural standpoint, did you have staff there that you could manage? How what does that look like in terms of managing, you know, that geography, if you will?
Yeah, it's a challenge. You know, we're a small state, and due to that, we're a small staff state. I was fortunate before the pandemic hit to hit all those major cities and get a taste of their culture and get a taste of what their challenges are respectively, and to maybe provide what resources I could. The pandemic slowed that down, and you know, the fortunate thing is we're starting to get back up and running in terms of getting out and about. I would argue, or I should say, you know, I'm an old school, if you will, director, Giovanni, and I like to be hands-on. So it's important for me to get out and about. And I think that's the best way to learn what your resources are and what the challenges are for that local community. So I'm still learning. I'll be the first one to tell you. I'm fortunate to have a, you know, I would say some part-time staff through our ODP and coaching education program that are involved locally with clubs, but also involved locally with the high school programs that I would say are priceless to me in terms of reference and resource points. So, you know, when we create programs, they're the first person I call to find out if there's even a value to that program for them in their own individual community.
You know, one of the things that, you know, I believe in when you oversee any entity, whether you're DOC of a soccer organization or, you know, CEO of a company, I believe in vision, a common vision, you know, a common path toward a, you know, desired goals and expectations, that type of thing. Did you have a particular vision when you arrived? You sorted out the landscape in Louisiana, you got a feel for what the vibe down there. Did you say to yourself, okay, this is where I'd like to see player development go? This is where I'd like to see coaching, education, and development go. Did you have that internal conversation? Did you have an external conversation? And if so, what was that vision? What did it look like? What did it sound like?
Yeah, you know, and I'll be the first one to tell you, I think my plan A, you know, was probably naive. And then plan B comes into play because, you know, now you know more, right? You learn more and you have better reference tools. So what we're doing now, in terms of, player development, we've created a scouting program across the state for ODP as an example. Another example is we've reinvigorated an academy program across the state for 9 and 10 year olds, and we are in the process of introducing, and I call them technical programs for lack of better terms, but you know, just introducing to small communities, small areas, you know, if you will, 4-week penicillin shots of technical training for 9, 10, and 11 year olds, where their coaches can come out and learn, as well as, you know, we hopefully educate and develop some of their players. So I think it's a twofold. I've always believed in approaching things, you know, not only from a top down, but from a bottom up. You know, so we're trying with the scouting program to do a top down, but also from the bottom up, these technical programs. So we're slowly, if you will, starting to increase, I think, across the state, programming that will give us foundational as well as, you know, if you will, elite type services.
Any pushback? I mean, because invariably, as you very well know, I guess I already know the answer to that one. As you very well know, when there's the new sheriff in town and they come in with, you know, their vision and their expectations, you know, was there pushback?
Yeah, there. You know, and you're right, Giovanni. There always is, right? There always is. There's always some challenges and obstacles. You know, the big thing I've learned to stress over the years is collaboration. So for example, what may work in a small community, you know, south of New Orleans may not work in Lafayette. So, you know, how do we adapt it? And what I tell people all the time is, you know, if you want to criticize, that's great, you know, but at the end of the day, you gotta help us find a solution, because anyone can criticize. But to me, it takes a professional to learn how to collaborate and solve problems.
You know, I have been very fortunate, Brian, to travel to a number of countries to specifically learn, you know, how they're developing players, how they're developing coaches, and just philosophies. And there are two things that I always, when I'm done with said visit, I walk away with two things that I find to be common amongst all these soccer nations. A is collaboration, as you just noted. The other one is reflection. But staying on the theme of collaboration, I have tried, and share with me, you know, your thoughts on this, you know, with the organizations I oversee for folks to collaborate both formally and informally. I have called on, mm-hmm. you know, again, where I oversee, you know, 38 clubs, you know, to formally, maybe once a month, your DOCs, the president of your club, your coaches of specific age groups, you formally get together, whether it's, you know, well, post COVID, over a cup of coffee, or you do it, you know, via Zoom. Or just informally, you just happen to connect with someone from Club A and you're from Club B and you get together for a said cup of coffee and you collaborate. It is always fascinating to me how much of a challenge it is for folks, because it requires coaches, administrators, and organizations as a whole to be vulnerable, to have the capacity to open up to someone else from another club who oftentimes you may be competing against. To mm-hmm. say, hey, we're facing this problem. We're facing this issue. Geez, how did you guys handle that? What are your thoughts on, you know, that aspect, the formal versus informal? And was any of that instituted in your work in Louisiana?
Yeah, I think those are great terms, Giovanni. And I think subconsciously, you know, I've always kind of done those as well. We do have, we start off with some formal meetings, you know, in person. But over time, what I'm finding out here, is the informal seems to be much more valuable. And they range from phone calls or, you know, the odd lunching if you're able to based on the pandemic protocols, or even like a quick Zoom meeting and so on. I'm finding my experience here is that the informal ones, achieve more. You get, I think, more of a candid conversation simply because of what you said earlier. It's a great term, I think, to use, is that when you're in a large formal organizational meeting, it's hard for people to be vulnerable, right? I'll say this. There's no, when you're in the formal environment, it's almost as if you're being tested sometimes. And people don't like to be tested. They don't like to be that open or that vulnerable. The informal, there is no test. It's just me and it's you having a conversation, you know, and it, a lot of times it's those off cuff conversations that create new resources or new programming. And I would say that's been the biggest learning curve for me here is, seeing the value of those informal conversations. They've helped me out probably more than anything else.
Well, you know, a prime example of that, Brian, and you've seen it firsthand, like I have. You go to the coaches convention, United Soccer Coaches, yep. Coaches Convention, and you go to any bar, right? And you see coaches doing the informal thing. They're moving salt shakers around or beer bottles, You know, and having those informal conversations, those informal exchanges back and forth, you know, or in the morning over a cup of coffee, you sit down, you happen to be sitting next to somebody from Louisiana, let's say, and you start those informal conversations. So they do take place. I just think it's super important to put that to the forefront of people's consciousness and organizational consciousness to do that. You mentioned ODP. Share with my audience the scene, the club scene down there and the ODP scene. And if, you know, there's any, you know, conflict or you know, differences between the two that one kind of bumps into the other. What does that look like down in Louisiana?
Yeah, it's still challenging, right? Because I think ODP is going through a metamorphosis, you know, with the advent, obviously, of the academy programs, MLS Next, the GA, so on, whatever it's called, ECNL. You know, in Louisiana, we don't have any of the GA or ECNL or MLS Next. So ODP is still a viable option for players. What we've had to do since I've been here is we've had to try and regain some value and reinvigorate professionalism and a certain level of integrity to the program again. And fortunately, we've been very, very good in finding collaboration with the local clubs, whose staff obviously we rely on, not only for the training sessions, but also the scouting programs. And they've been very good. The parents have been very good. One thing we're learning is that, you know, you cannot over communicate when it comes to, elite players. I think those parents and those players, because they invest a lot of their time, they want to know what's going on, right? They want to return on their investment, if you will. And sometimes the best way to return that investment, Giovanni, is to keep them involved in the programming through communication. So it's still a challenge, right? I mean, do we get the best players all the time? Probably not. Are we getting better? I would say from last year to this year, we've increased the level of our players at least by a level and a half to two levels. And it's been exciting to see. We had some MLS scouts come in last year, and we've had a couple we've sent videos to this year. And I think we're starting to show at least a small step, Giovanni. I think we're starting to show that we do have the talent in small pockets that would interest, you know, next level coaches. And a lot, I got to give credit to a lot of the club coaches, you know, who have been very helpful in helping us push forward the program.
You know, I'm a little older than you. And I remember, you know, okay, I'm a lot older than you. You know, the Olympic Development Program was the premier level of play for any high level player. And I go back long enough to say there was no such thing as club soccer. I mean, we had youth soccer, the town organizations, and even those were new, relatively new to the soccer scene. And it was interesting to see, over the course of, you know, because I've re-engaged with ODP in recent years, how the landscape has indeed changed with ODP, and it has everything to do with the advent of clubs, the advent of these very many high level leagues that clubs are going to you know, associate themselves with, particularly if you're a premier level you know, organization, and what it's done to ODP. So you're right, ODP is kind of struggling with its identity, I think, a little bit, and who are we? How can we serve this? Our soccer community in a landscape where our competition, and I kind of use that term loosely, which are clubs, which, heck, they've got good coaches, they've got good infrastructure, organization, they can compete in these leagues that, you know, that week in and week out can offer high level competition. It's difficult. It's difficult. And it's part of and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. It's part of an American soccer landscape that is fraught with so many soccer entities that it becomes so fragmented that we maybe do more harm than good. Is that a stretch to say?
Big question, Brian. No, it is. And I think it's always going to be a debate. how about this? I think the best way to answer that, Giovanni, is I think there's been a lot of missteps. You know, and when I say missteps, I don't think we can point the finger necessarily at U.S. soccer, USU soccer, or whoever. But there's been some missteps where I think if more collaboration was set into place, you know, I think we could find one or two platforms of programming where our elite players would have better opportunities. The entry point for, you know, lower income players would be better. The entry point just to play soccer would be better. But I think also that the top of the pyramid would be that much better. So, yeah, I don't disagree. I think because of the lack of collaboration, it's created, let's be honest, Giovanni, how many platforms are out there now? You know, you out and at least say that there's what, you know, 20 plus, who knows? So I agree. I agree. I think it's been a bit of an alphabet soup, unfortunately. The positive though, and this is probably the uniqueness to, you know, the American culture, is because we have so many platforms, we still do produce some quality players, and we're seeing it now with this new generation, you know, with Christian Pulisic and Zach Steffen, McKenny, and now McKenzie's about to go over, and Brian Reynolds is going over. So we're starting to see it, but how great would it have been if the collaboration happened 20 years ago, and instead of naming off a half a dozen kids, we would be naming off, you know, three dozen.
Amen. Amen. You hit it right on the head. Indeed, if these, the spirit of collaboration, and it's got to be driven by U.S. soccer. It has to be, because they're the governing body of the game here in the United States. And, you know, and I'm going to discuss this more formally in as part of this theme of the state of the game. Because of the uniqueness of the American sporting culture, the uniqueness of the American soccer culture, you know, I think it's imperative that U.S. soccer, you know, formally reaches out. And from what I understand, it's starting to happen, you know, to the high school game, to the college game, where we can, I don't know if you can formally bring them under the, you know, U.S. soccer umbrella. I don't think the NCAA would ever do that. But in some way, shape, or form, we recognize the uniqueness of the soccer culture here in the United States, the soccer landscape, and then to bring it under a somewhat of a common tent, so as to best utilize all those resources, and they are indeed vast when you really think about it, toward a common end, and that is developing world-class American soccer players. You know, and call me idealistic, you know, call me naive, but I think if that were to take place, my goodness, as you stated so nicely there, we could be rattling off far more players over the course of generations.
Yeah, let me tell you this quick anecdote story, Giovanni, that's similar, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
I remember when I was taking my UEFA B and A courses in Scotland, you know, part of the course back then, so we're talking, you know, 2004-ish, part of the if you will, the assessment process is they would interview you during the course. Right. So it would be the two instructors interviewing Giovanni, asking you, how do you think things are going? What could you do better? You know, where do you see yourself improving? What's your plan? You know, what's your development plan, your future goals? Walk us through a couple of scenarios on the pitch here and there. You know, give us your philosophy theory. Right. So I vividly remember this, and I don't want to say who the instructors were because I don't want to reveal their identity. I think that's wrong. But the conversation they had with me lasted about 45 minutes. And after the first 5 minutes, the remaining 40 minutes, Giovanni, you know what we spoke about? Exactly what you just brought up. The fact that if we got everything together in the U.S., we would dominate potentially world soccer, and they were worried about it. They wanted to know why we're not there. They couldn't, for them, again, bear in mind, you know, they're coming from a totally different environment. They didn't understand high school soccer, collegiate soccer, how club soccer worked, ODP at the time, so on. They kept, for 40 minutes, I was drilled about questions about what American soccer landscape was.
Yeah, I've experienced the same thing in my travels, different different nations. They look, you know, how come you guys aren't any better? Why, you know, because, you know, you look at the United States and, you know, the perception is, you know, big, vast, and, you know, well-to-do and resources. And my most recent trip was to Iceland.
Oh, wow.
I'll tell you what, Brian, that's a must trip for two reasons. It's a must trip as a soccer professional, and it's also a must trip just as a tourist. I'll give you that much. But yeah, Iceland, as you very well know, has done very well, you know, internationally. Mm-hmm. And it's this island nation tucked up in the North Atlantic, 340,000 people, right? And I'll tell you what, it was arguably one of the highlights of my soccer learning, you know, learning experiences to see what they do in Iceland, given all the challenges they face. It's really extraordinary. But again, you travel around, and invariably the question would come up, you know, how come you're not any better? And how come you don't produce these world-class players and da, 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 da. But yeah, it's a common, common assessment, I guess.
But let me just add this, Giovanni, please, real quick. But I do want to make sure, you know, for those that are listening, that, you know, despite all that, we are producing some fantastic players. I mean, here's the great thing I think that's happening now. You mentioned it before, collaboration. One of the things that I'm familiar with is the collaboration that MLS is doing with not only their academy programs, but some of the MLS next clubs. And I think we're on the cusp of something here that could be very fruitful for our top elite players. The shame of it all is that it's taken this long, if that makes sense. You know, I think what MLS is doing with some of their academies and some of the policies and protocols are putting in place for player development is fantastic. The scouting program and so on. The sad part is, again, it's taken this long, Giovanni, but I do feel that we're, like you mentioned earlier, we're about to turn the curve. So I'm excited to see what the next generation brings.
You know what I have to do for myself, Brian, periodically, because I have these conversations with folks like you, numerous times. You got to stop and think of putting things in terms of historical context. The game here in the United States is still relatively young when you really think about it. And you look at, you know, as I refer to first world soccer nations, you're looking at clubs that were started in the 1800s or the early, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. They've got hundreds of years of history, and their soccer experiences are far more, you know, longer than ours. And I got to kind of give myself a quasi slap in the face and say, hey man, you know, in your lifetime, my 62 years on this planet, and God knows 40 years in as a professional in the game, we've made great strides. So I agree. And in as much as I can be harsh, or we can be harsh about the landscape, and we should be better, could be better, I circle back and kind of ground myself to say, you know, over the last, say, 40 years of my professional life, my goodness, in every aspect, we have made strides. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you look at the women's game and how they developed and how they I think they're starting to kind of even focus more on the development side of the young girls. And then you look at the men's side, and I mean, who would have thought, right, Giovanni, between you and I, and I guess the listeners, who would have thought that we would be having players playing for Man City and Chelsea, you know, arguably two of the top, 10, 12 clubs in the world. And we have a player at Juventus. I mean, I grew up watching the Italian league, you know, on RAI, if people can remember that channel. And let me tell you, I mean, you know, I grew up watching the AC Milan and Juventus and Sampdoria, Bologna and Genoa. And all of a sudden now I get to watch an American play. To me, it's sometimes we do have to take a step back and acknowledge how far we've come in such a short amount of time.
Indeed. Let's circle back. As I noted earlier in our conversation, that you do have experience in other parts of the country now. And again, this being the quote unquote state of the game, you do have the kill three birds at one stone. Talk to my audience a little bit. Let's focus on PA. You spent some time with FC Delco. And you were the academy director there. What was that landscape like? Player development, coaching developments, the infrastructure in Pennsylvania. What was that like?
Yeah, Mike Barr, with Eastern PA. He does a great job. I think, you know, for what he's been able to do on such a large state, as well as a state that, you know, has multiple professional teams with the Philadelphia Union, he's done a great job, I think, from an educational standpoint. So I got to give him credit where credit's due. You know, that Philadelphia, New Jersey, Northern Delaware is a hotbed of player production, you know, from an ethnic and cultural standpoint, but I think also too, from a working class standpoint, you know, you find a nice mix of players. It was challenging, you know, I'll be honest with you, Giovanni, it was challenging because there is a multitude of players. And obviously with the great, level of players comes challenges dealing with, you know, egos, whether it's players, parents, and coaches. But, you know, we try to do our best in terms of building relationships. More importantly, our main focus is trying to build a relationship with the Philadelphia Union Academy, with Tommy Wilson, who does a fantastic job there. And I think, you know, his results speak for himself with so many players being pushed through the first team and Brendan Aaronson now going over to Europe to play. So we were fortunate to have some good collaboration with those guys and, you know, with their school program that Richie Graham has developed. So, it was a good experience. It was challenging because of, you know, there were so many resources and with players and so on and so forth. It was, again, I think to me, it's a hotbed and it always will be a hotbed for quality players.
And what about in Michigan? You spent some time with a club there and then with Michigan State Youth Soccer Association. What was Michigan is an up and coming, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of an up and coming soccer state.
I would say this, Giovanni, I think Michigan to me is a majorly untapped resource for players and coaches. Very professional setups across the landscape of Michigan. Coaches were always eager to learn. The players were passionate. I mean, you know, not to be stereotypical, but you have this because of the culture of the weather and the culture of the car industry. You have some players that, you know, they can grind it out. And I was fortunate to work with some top talented players that went on to Michigan State, Duke, and Notre Dame to play in the College Cup semifinals and finals. And I got to tell you, how about this, Giovanni? I think the best way I can say this would be this. If I was in charge of an MLS academy or even in charge of a collegiate program, one of my priorities would be to put Michigan soccer on my list because there are players that are in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years that are coming out of that state that can help your programs, but more importantly, that are going to go on to some big things. You know, we have some players right now that are playing in the professional leagues in MLS and USL, and we have some young ladies that have been fantastic that came out of the Hawks program that played at UVA and Stanford. So to me, it's an exciting ground for someone to go and, if you will, tap some of those resources.
And the receptiveness, because we talked about pushback a little while ago, the receptiveness of some of the things or all of the things that you wanted to implement, whether it be at Delco or in your roles in Michigan, you know, did you find it far more amenable to things you wanted to do and implement versus, you know, some of the pushbacks you kind of noted in Louisiana?
Yeah. Well, look, I don't want to mislead anyone. The Delco job was tough. I mean, there's only two types of coaches in the world, Giovanni, those that have been fired and those waiting to be fired. And I was fired at Delco because I think some of the changes may have been, I don't know if we call them too radical or just, maybe not ready for it, or maybe I was too naive. Whatever people want to choose, feel free to choose. In Michigan, it was a different boat. People want it. How about this? That environment there is people want the best for their son or their daughter, right? And what does that mean? That means that they're going to find a way, you know, whether they have the money or not, they'll drop their kid off on a Monday and they'll pick their kid up on a Sunday for Sunday dinner. If their son or daughter wants to train every day of the week, if their son or daughter wants this or that, they will provide for it. And I think that the culture in Michigan for me was really telling, to the point where they want it more. And because they want it more, I think they were open to new ideas and just if you will, collaborating more for the benefit of their own son or daughter, or even for the benefit of them as coaches.
You know, what you're touching upon here is what I'm going to refer to as state culture.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about, you know, national culture. The Italians are a certain way. The Germans are a certain way. And the English are a certain way. And, you know, the way the game is played is a reflection of that. But here in the United States, because of our vastness, we're talking about state culture. I found it fascinating. You're talking about kids in Michigan who wanted to grind it out because of the culture of the auto industry and the type of folks who are in that industry, and you know, their human characteristics, and then it's a reflection of you know, the kids and how they compete as athletes. That's a fascinating thing to kind of examine, this idea of state culture as it reflects, or as it affects, if you will, you know, player development and certainly coaching development. I want to get into, because I'm looking at, you know, the things you try to implement in at Delco and in Michigan, because they're pretty much the same. Talk to me about, as I'm looking at here, your establishment of what you refer to as an individual player development plan. Now, I was a teacher for 24 mm-hmm. years, so I'm familiar with an IEP, you know, individual educational plan.
Yep.
Talk to my audience, what your idea, what did you try to do with an individual development plan?
Yeah. So I'll give you a couple examples that we do. First off, depending on the age of the player, let's deal with a 13-year-old boy or girl, just as a, from an arbitrary standpoint. At that age, they're cognizant enough to hopefully start to do some self-reflection. So we would have them do a self-reflection kind of survey. Identify their positives, you know, and some of their weaknesses. We would sit down with them and their parent and find ways together to develop a plan. That plan would include anything of any array of these things here, Giovanni. Maybe adding an additional training session with either a cross-gender team, a team that's older or a team that's younger, right? Because if it's a question of confidence, sometimes training down is great, right? If it's something where they need to be challenged on a physical standpoint, playing up is another option. So that would be one element of that individual training program. And we would usually start off maybe once a week and see how their bodies manage it for about 4 weeks. And if it's going well, we would maintain that process. The other bucket that we'd approach is we have a homework program that I use, and I would ask them, you know, how often can you do these homework assignments? And if, you know, if they were able to do it two times a week or three times a week, a lot of the activities, Giovanni, we created would only take about maybe 15 to 30 minutes. So they could come actually to training early and do it, as an example, or they could stay late and do it afterwards. And again, it wasn't anything major, anything from some quick Korver issues to what I call struggle juggles, where you sit on the ground, you throw the ball up in the air, and you stand up and try and do a juggling sequence and then sit back down and do the same thing. So we're working on that balance and kinesthetic sense. And to be honest, Giovanni, I'm a firm believer in jump rope. I think, you know, speed ladders are speed ladders, but at the end of the day, someone has yet to convince me that jumping rope doesn't help increase your foot speed. And guess what? A jump rope only cost about $9 the last time I checked. So, you know, again, these 13, 14-year-old boys and girls, their individual development plan would range anywhere from an additional training session with a team up or down or cross-gender to, you know, a 15-minute pre-training workout of activities or post-training activities. You know, and we would have them just kind of file, if you will, just like a minor journal, minor document with us so that we could keep track. And that's what we tried to do. Some players bought in, Giovanni, as you know, You know, some players buy in, some parents buy in more than the players. Some parents didn't care, and believe it or not, as you're well aware, you know, I would say some players didn't care either. But it was always out on the offer of the table.
You know, it's a great thing. Essentially, Brian, what you're doing is you're empowering the players to assess their own development, you know,
yep.
And then by association, they own it. They own it. This is what I need to do. This is where I need to go. This is what the help I need. And by them processing that and by them having these internal conversations and hopefully putting it into a journal, they then own it. And there is then, at least through all my years of as being an educator, there is accountability. Yep. Well, listen, this, you said it, you wrote it down, you wanted it. This is, so you own it. There is that level of accountability, which I think done well, and you certainly have done it well, can be a great tool for inspiring players to, you know, want to get better and try different things and challenge themselves to become better players. That's safe to say?
I would say so. And, you know, as they got, and again, as they get older, you know, we actually would let them design the activities, Giovanni. So again, it goes back to your concept of the individual owning and accepting their accountability, because what we found at 15, they would come up with some great activities. And it was amazing to me to see them, you know, at 15 come to practice early to do those activities, you know, something as minor as working on free kicks or, you know, working on, you know, driving the ball. Again, just minor examples, but it was just great to see because these are activities that they designed. And to me, that was probably, if, you know, we do this job, Giovanni, because at the end of the day, you know, we're probably not going to be multimillionaires, but we do it for some sort of intrinsic reward. And that's what's rewarding to me is seeing these young boys and girls at 15, 16 taking true accountability of their own development. You know, to me, that's what brings me a smile.
I want to touch upon an area that is near and dear to my heart, Brian, and that is the idea of creativity and developing creative players. Coinciding with that is the idea of free play. Giving players environments, literally giving them environments where they are free to play. And this is something that I've implemented from the grassroots level to the most advanced players I coached when I was coaching at the college level. What are your thoughts on this idea of allowing players opportunities to play freely, even though they may be coming to, you know, at 6 o'clock, we have training at X field, but when we get there, it's not the typical training environment. It's basically a backyard or, you know, the park. Talk to my audience about that idea of free play. And then by association, if they're indeed association, the idea of developing creative players through that dynamic.
I'm a believer in it as well, Giovanni. I think there's, you know, let me, I'll try and be brief, but I've personal principles and philosophies I abide to, particularly when it comes to coaching. I believe that there's three types of training sessions, Giovanni. The first one is an education session, you know, where you might be working on tactics, right? The other ones, I call it, you know, if you will, a fitness session. And then the third one is what I call a training session. And in that training session itself, you know, there's got to be moments where the players play. And so, for example, one of the things we did in Michigan quite a bit at our academy program was we did a 2v2 program almost once a week. And you and I, as players, we get there, we play against two players. The next two that play that arrive on the field, we play 2v2 games to 5 goals, 6 goals, or an 8-minute time frame and just rotate. And we would literally do that for an hour and a half. And in fact, we would go inside when the weather was bad and we would do the same thing. No coaching, right? The field was the only thing that the coaches did would have them set up. And I can tell you from that environment alone, allowing the players to referee their own game and allowing players to just play without you as the coach being the figure, was fantastic. The only time we intervened was obviously if there was a major foul or if we had to blow the whistle to move the game onwards. So I would argue, you know, in all this coaching education plethora of ABCs and 1-2-3s that we see coming out every year from different curriculums, I would argue that an aspect of the training session has to be where we just let them play. You know, a fitness session is a fitness session, and an education session for a team is an education session. But the training session, there's something to be said about Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, right? Where the game was the teacher, whether it's 77, 99. I'm a huge fan of 2v2. So I guess to some degree, you know, you're preaching to the choir, Giovanni. I'm 100% behind that.
Yeah, it's, you know, we in our, I'll use the term traditional sports here in the United States, I think of basketball. You know, stop and think we're you know, all these great players learn the game. They learn, you know, either in the driveway if it's suburbia or, you know, in an urban setting on the public parks. You know, I grew up playing hockey a little bit, you know, being from the Boston area, and I grew up during the big bad Bruin era and played hockey, but we played shinny hockey. We went to the local pond. And it was just you and a bunch of your friends and sometimes just one puck. And you just, you know, you had the puck, you kept it for as long as you could until someone took it away from you. And, you know, that was free play, as was the case in basketball. That's free play. And you learn how to improvise. You learn how to problem solve. You learn how to be creative with another player. And it's always astonishing to me how soccer here in this country, you know, that crossover didn't take place where, heck, you know, why don't we just let these kids play and, you know, or create or encourage them just to go out in the backyard of the park and just play soccer. I'm on board with you that the idea of creativity and free play is you know,
to super add important. To that, Giovanni, one thing I'd recommend even to our listeners is that, you know, just the free play in your own team is great. Don't get me wrong, but why not just have two teams and enjoy free play across age groups or across genders? You know, we had a 2v2 winter program in Michigan. And let me tell you, it was across three different age groups and both genders. And the response from the players was fantastic. It took a while for the parents to buy into it. But I can tell you, because of the fact you had different players from different teams and different genders, it was actually much more inviting for the players. Because, you know, one week I'm playing with you, Giovanni. The next week I'm playing with someone else and you're playing with someone else. And because of that, that's where the creativity comes into play. Because now, you know, one week, maybe you dominate it. The next week, I dominate it because I was with a different partner and vice versa. So I would encourage everyone to do the free play, but let's not just restrict it to your team. Open it up. Let kids be kids for a little while.
You know, I had a conversation with a gentleman overseas, a youth soccer organization. And as a formal part of their play, they would have, I forget what it was, like memory is a little vague on this. I think it was maybe once a month or twice a month, where on a Saturday or a Sunday, you know, you just bring your kids to play. You didn't bring your team, just bring your kids to play. And they would just sort it out and you just play. Oh, we've got this many 9-year-olds. We've got this many 12-year-olds, this many 14. Go and play. And it was just open, free play. The parents loved it. I mean, the parents, according to this gentleman, the parents loved it. The kids obviously loved it, you know, because they could just go out and play. So I echo your enthusiasm and sentiments about all of this in terms of, you know, if you're oversee an organization, a youth soccer organization, a club or a state association that you employ these types of free play environments for our kids, because my goodness, you know, that's where we really learn the game in the streets and free play and that type of environment. So Brian, here we go. This is with all my guests, season 4 GP Soccer Podcast, the state of the game. I always ask the final question.
Sure.
What is the state of the game? And for your case, because you can kill three birds at one stone, in Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and in Michigan, and then in your general overview of the state of the game here in the United States. I got you on that one, huh?
Cool. Yeah, it's a tough one.
Brian, I don't ask, because, you know, I ask questions, man. I ask questions.
Yeah, I would say this. I think before the pandemic, I think the state of the game was moving in the right direction with there seems to be a lot more collaboration, particularly at the elite level. And with the clubs, I think with the pandemic, you know, we have what, 12-14% unemployment. Some states are struggling with numbers anywhere from about 50% lower to 20% lower. The Aspen report has come out and said, you know, there's a good chance that 20 to 25% of the players may not return because they found alternative things for sports. So Giovanni, I'll be the first one to tell you, I don't know what the state of the game is going to be like at the grassroots level. I think it's, there's going to be a lot more obstacles because of, the cost entry point as well as the time entry point, because I think the economy is going to force a lot of people to have multiple jobs and we'll call them irregular hour jobs. So, you know, transportation will be an issue. I do think the elite side of things is going to be relatively stable, simply because those parents and those players are kind of, if you will, quote unquote, in the system. And, you know, their personalities and the culture of the elite side is, if you will, a little bit more mature. So where's the state of the game? I guess in one term, I'm going to say nebulous right now. I don't know. I don't know where it's going to turn. I fear for the generation that is 9, 10, 11, and 12. I think the pandemic hurt those numbers because in 2018, the uptick in youth sports participation was quite high compared to the years prior. Due to the pandemic, those numbers have obviously been depleted significantly, and particularly in those age groups. So I worry for the 9, 10, and 11, 12-year-olds right now more than anyone else. I think the older, the high school generation is going to be fine. The grassroots generation and the 9, 10, 11, and 12 generations, I think, are going to, they're going to be facing some challenges. On whether or not sports is going to be a safe reentry, whether the cost for reentry is going to be sustainable, and whether the time and transportation for reentry is going to be sustainable. So I don't know if that's an answer, Giovanni, and I apologize, but that's probably my best educated guess.
No, that is your answer. And that's the beauty of my trying to do all this. The answers are going to be different. And believe me, they have been different. And that's important, because all those, the million-dollar question, as I describe it, you know, is going to be representative of some really important soccer people like yourself. So, you know, at the end of all of this, you know, we're going to look at, you know, what is the state of the game and the opinions of folks like you, and then, you know, maybe we can come to a consensus. Maybe we can't come to a consensus. Maybe this is something that really rears its head or it doesn't. That's the kind of the beauty of all this. You know, what you're talking about here, again, we connect back to COVID. I guess we can't escape it, is what the new, this is the new phrase, the new normal is going to be post-COVID. I mean, we talk about a new economy and, you know, and things like that, what society might look like. But from a soccer standpoint, what will the new normal look like? And you hit some very important things there. You know, talk about, you know, reentry into the game or things being prohibited because of pricing. Those are all, you know, very important things that have, you know, COVID-19 has affected it. And what will all that look like, or the effects of that, what will it look like post-COVID? Only time will tell, Brian. Only time will tell. So
yeah, exactly.
So listen, Brian, I want to thank you so much. This has been a terrific conversation. You know, and it's going to be a great addition to the theme of the state of the game here on my podcast. So, ladies and gentlemen, our guest today has been Brian Thorpe. And Brian is, again, the Technical Director of Coaching Education and Player Development for Louisiana Soccer Association. We're going to break for a couple of commercials. And on the other side, we will reengage. Don't go anywhere. My name is Giovanni Pacini. This is the GP Soccer Podcast. I'll catch you on the other side. Are you a player or a parent of a player who is passionate about playing soccer at the collegiate level, but don't understand the process of where to start? Don't have enough time to spend researching? Don't understand what coaches are looking for or at what level your child needs to be playing at? What about academic and social environments, admissions, financial aid? So much to consider. Well, you're not alone. My Soccer Advocate is your go-to source in finding the support and guidance you'll need to sort out this challenging process. My Soccer Advocate will help parents and players minimize the anxiety about what to do and arm you with the knowledge and support to give players and parents the best chance possible of reaching their dream. Our goal is to provide personal service to make your life easier. Youth soccer and club organizations can utilize My Soccer Advocate services, particularly when your coaches or administrators might not have the time or the connections in guiding players and parents through the college search process. Your players and families can then feel they are getting the needed support and a full package of service out of your organization. Contact My Soccer Advocate for a free consultation at info@mysocceradvocate.com and visit on the web at mysocceradvocate.com. What if there was a training method that was designed to revolutionize the sports landscape? One that encompasses more joy, peace, and love by showing athletes, parents, and coaches how to take greater responsibility for the development of healthy individual and cultural identities. Well, that method is what Yanni Training is all about. Through their workshops for youth and professional soccer clubs and through their two revolutionary guidebooks, On Frame, Exploring the Depths of Parenting in the World of Youth Soccer, and The Coaching Revolution, an interactive guide to finding joy and excellence in coaching, Yanni Training can help raise your awareness of the deep issues in the profession and how they affect your coaching experience. It's time for our culture to acknowledge that soccer is a deep experience for all of us. Go to yannitraining.com, that's IANNITraining.com, to find out how your club can solve some of the most profound problems in youth sports and return to playing soccer with joy and excellence every day.
My name is Warren Backman from Regis College Men's Soccer, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back, everybody. Giovanni Pacini here, GP Soccer Podcast. I'm going to have to have Warren come back or, you know, have him redo that bumper because he's no longer at Regis. He's going to have to say, hey, this is Warren Backman, assistant coach at Lynn University. So, Warren, if you're listening, let's make sure we retape a new bumper. But I plugged that in because, as I noted to you at the beginning, my friend Warren is heading down to Lynn University. So I hope you enjoyed today's conversation with Brian Thorpe. Goodness knows I enjoyed having the conversation with him. Hopefully you have learned a little bit about or learned a lot more about the state of the game down in not only Louisiana, but in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. So thanks again to Brian for appearing on the show and contributing to what I think is a very important series, that being the state of the game. So on the last block here, before we close out the show, as you know, I always try to plug in something that is either relative to the conversation or something that I think is important to the state of the game. And so today's topic, if you will, in this last block of the GP Soccer Podcast has to do with the importance of free play, the importance of free play. You know, I've been at this game of coaching education for many years, and it's been very, very satisfying. And every time I have the chance to deliver a coaching education course, it's is with great pride that I do so, and I believe it is extraordinarily important. But you know, along the way, we dive so deep in this idea that we've got to implement this particular methodology. You know, I've got to do, you know, play, practice, play. I've got to do whole, part, whole. I've got to, you know, phase play or functional training or whatever. In the laundry list of methodologies are certainly out there. And if you've been around the game long enough, you've taken coach education courses, you know them all, right? The point I'm trying to make is throughout all of that, all of which are very important, we lost sight of the fact or have lost sight to some degree of the importance of just letting the kids play, just letting them play. I'm old enough to remember that, you know, when I was growing up, when you got home from school and you had no homework or whatever, you went out to play. It was just part of, when I was growing up, you just went out to play and you got together with your friends. And in my case, we played, pickup sports. We played endless games of street hockey or Sandlot baseball. I had to coax kids to play soccer because there was not a lot of soccer players out there. But when out there, we participated in sports, or we went off to create these games. We used to play army. you know, if there was a bunch of us and we used to, you know, break off branches of trees and those were the guns, and we created these environments, these fantasies, and we played a game. You know, we used our imaginations to create these environments of which we participated in, and we were all the better for it. But in the physical part, when we went out to play, or when kids go out to play, you know, you run, you jump, you skip, you jog, you trip, you fall, you get back up, you climb all over things. You're climbing trees, you're climbing jungle gyms, you're doing all of the things that you know, go along with going out to play, particularly if you're, you know, involved in anything that's, you know, athletic or active. Why is that important? Well, it's super important because going out to play and building all of those, and I'll use this term cautiously, skills, if you will, because they are to a certain degree, you are creating or developing what we call physical literacy. When I was a physical education teacher for 24 years and I spent a number of those years at the elementary level where I had, you know, little, you know, kindergartners all the way up to sixth grade. And in the later part of my years, I was at the high school level. But the idea of physical literacy at the younger stage was super, super important. You know, we did a lot of fun activities using, gross motor skills and, where they could kind of, lay the foundation of what eventually would be, you know, the opportunity to use fine motor skills when they got older, right? And in the development of physical literacy, whether it be in physical education class as an elementary school physical education teacher or that environment, or just going out to play, it creates a foundation on which sports-specific skills are built. So if you're a kid out there and you've gone out there and played for years and now it's, hey, I want to play soccer, you know, you are now have a solid foundation by which these soccer-specific skills can now be built and developed, right? And all the things that coincided with going out to play, well, stop and think about it. They do take place on the field. You know, you trip, you fall, you get up, you run, you skip, you leap, all those things. You're not climbing a tree, but you get my point. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very long way of me saying, if you're a teacher of the game out there, in particular the grassroots level, be sure that with regularity, you're creating environments when the kids arrive to the field. You've got the equipment there waiting for them, and you say, you know what, folks, have at it. Create your own games. I don't care if it's 1 versus 1, 2 versus 2, 3 versus 3. And if it's an odd number, you have them figured out. Let them play. Let them play. And if they come running to you with there's an example I just gave. Hey, coach, we've got 7 players. You know, what do we do? You give them the 3 magic words. Magic words. Figure it out. Figure it out. And they will figure it out. They will go back and they will figure it out. Maybe they will, they'll play with a +1 play. Maybe they'll have a sub, whatever. But they have now gone back and sorted out the challenge and played the game, right? I was a college coach for 26 or 27 years as a head coach. And there were days, depending on the schedule, right, where it was free play. It was free play. And my goodness, if you wanted to see a group of, 20-something college players, revert back to their childhoods. Well, it was those days when I said today is a free play day. And usually I let them, your favorite uniform, we relaxed the dress code for training, and they would come out with their favorite shirt or whatever. And I let them play. And even though, they were having a boatload of fun, and they were, and it was great for them psychologically, they were still put in environments where they would have to problem solve. I mean, at the end of the day, these are college guys, and they get out, and they would go at it a little bit. And they'd have to solve things, solve problems, invariably you would see the center back would want to be the striker and the striker would want to be the center back or the goalkeeper who couldn't wait to get out of the goal. And there they were in these different dynamics on the field and they were, formally as part of the team. And in those roles that they had decided to take on, there were new challenges that they had to sort out, right? So this idea of free play has application even at the grassroots level, throughout high school, into college, and I dare say even at the professional level on those days where you want to do something that is fun, So when we talk about the state of the game, the importance of securing coaching education licenses, or as I talked about in the opening block, going on an academic track such as at Ohio University, very important. And that is an ongoing process, an ongoing process. It stops on the day you die. This idea of getting educated, this idea of evolving and learning, stops on the day you die. So my very, very strong message to all of you, when we talk about the state of the game relative to developing players, is to, with regularity, offer up free play. Let them play. And your job, particularly at the younger level, is to sit back and enjoy the show. Sit back and enjoy the show. Now, I know it's very tempting for coaches, particular parents. You know, you want to kind of shout out. You see something going on. You want to shout instructions. Do everything within your power not to. You know, and inform your parents, you know, if they decide to, you know, to sit on the side of the field and watch practice, that what it's going to be all about today. It's about free play. And just sit back and enjoy the children playing a game. The children playing a game. So free play. Make sure you, you know, you make that a regular part of your training regimen, no matter what level you happen to be coaching at. So that's the show for today. That's the show for today. Another what will be a very long list of episodes covering the theme, the state of the game. Our guest today again was Brian Thorpe. Many thanks again to him. So if you like what you heard today, please, please tell everyone. If you didn't, tell everyone anyway. If you'd like to advertise on the GP Soccer Podcast, you can contact me, Giovanni Pacini, at GP4Soccer, and that's the number 4 at yahoo.com, or at 617-968-1800. This is Giovanni Pacini of the GP Soccer Podcast, and I'll catch you later.